It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Democrat Mike Doyle, the longest serving current member of the U.S. House from Pennsylvania, announced Monday he will retire at the end of his term next year. And the scramble to try to succeed him has begun. Chris Potter is WESA's government and accountability editor. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
Chris, you broke news this announcement was coming just hours beforehand. But was there a broader sense that this was coming before yesterday?
Yeah, there was. There were a few things going on. One is that Mr. Doyle's fundraising throughout the year had been somewhat lackluster. He's never had to raise a huge amount of money, but there looked to be a kind of a spirited primary campaign coming up. He just didn't raise a lot. There were also some concerns dating back to the primary after Bill Peduto lost the mayoral nomination to Ed Gainey. Somebody close to the Peduto administration said, well, the person who has to look out now is Mike Doyle, because there's this sense of these progressive challengers kind of taking on longstanding Democratic politicians. And, you know, there's been a lot of concern about this. Mike Doyle is, as you said, the most senior member of the delegation. He's brought a lot of federal money to the area as a result. And people are kind of concerned about what that means and kind of where we go from here.
Why did Doyle say now was the time to announce this?
Yeah, I mean, his answer was, you know, it's time for a change of, you know, the generational change here. It's going to happen sometime. He has been around for a quarter century. There is a redistricting coming up, which he cited as well. Although, to be honest, I mean, as a longstanding incumbent, he would have had a pretty strong role in deciding where those lines went. So, you know, I mean, I think one could kind of read some tea leaves and say, you know, he did face a difficult primary challenge. The pundits will tell you that Democrats are very likely to lose the U.S. House next year. And, you know, maybe just sort of made a calculation as well that, you know, how much of this is worth it? Do I really want to do everything necessary to win and hold this seat?
Was he anticipating that difficult primary challenge? As far as I know, only one had declared at that point, and that was Jerry Dickinson.
That's right. Jerry Dickinson, a Pitt University law professor who ran against Mr. Doyle in 2020, lost by like a 2-1 margin. You know, so I don't know how seriously Doyle was taking that particular challenge. But there had also been rumors, as have now borne out, that State Representative Summer Lee would also run as well.
All right. So Dickinson, he's run before, so he's got at least that experience. Tell us anything else about him that you've noticed.
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, his first run for Congress, he had a big, you know, it's a lot about fundraising, unfortunately. You know, he had a big first quarter report in his 2020 run, and then the money kind of fell off. That has happened a little bit here as well, but he still managed to raise in the six-digit range each of the past couple quarters that he's run. He actually outraised Doyle, which is kind of leading, adding to those concerns people had. So he looks to be having a pretty viable campaign going forward here.
Then, as you just alluded, in an exclusive interview with you, State Representative Summer Lee said she was running for Doyle's seat.
Yeah, again, this is something that had been talked about for a few months. A lot of people were very excited. Ms. Lee has been basically kind of the standard bearer for an entire progressive movement, the very movement that helped topple Bill Peduto in the May primary. So a lot of people very excited about her entrance into the race today.
All right. To make that announcement so quickly, had she been planning this all along, whether Doyle was going to retire or not?
Yeah, I asked her that question when I spoke to her, and the answer was yes. And I think that's credible. I mean, I certainly had a pretty strong sense that she was going to be running a couple weeks ago. Doyle himself, there were people close to Doyle who didn't know as recently as this past Tuesday, a week ago, whether he would really drop out or not. So she was committed to run regardless of his decision.
You mentioned that Dickinson has been fundraising and has raised more funds than Doyle had at this point. How good of a fundraiser is Summer Lee?
Well, we haven't yet seen, she only announced it a couple hours ago, but I can tell you she is going to have access to both a local grassroots network, and there's going to be national money coming in as well. She's been backed apparently by Justice Democrats who support a lot of progressive candidates at the federal level. She's going to be a force to be reckoned with.
All right. Lee is a progressive. She's tried to push a progressive movement in the state. She's been in the House, though, less than 3 years. Republicans control the legislature. So has she had any influence at this point, really early on in her political career?
I mean, as you point out, it's tough because it's a party-driven system and a seniority-driven position. But, you know, she would say, look, I have, just by being there, by bringing the perspectives I have as a black woman from a economically disadvantaged community, I have changed the way Democrats think about and respond to issues. And she has had some effect. Last year, she took part in a sort of act of civil disobedience on the House floor that led to some police reforms last year in the wake of that tragic shooting. That tragic police shooting in East Pittsburgh.
Of course, she is representing a district of about 65,000 constituents. You run for a U.S. House seat in Pennsylvania, it's going to be about 800,000. They're allowed to run for two different offices at one time. Do we know if Lee will run for her state House seat and for Congress at the same time?
Asked her that as well. She said she hadn't made a decision about that. Obviously, the complexion of this race has changed greatly just in the past 24 hours.
All right. So what about other possible candidates? Bill Peduto will be out of office at the end of this year. Rich Fitzgerald will be term limited, the county executive.
I find it hard to believe that either of those gentlemen will run. Mr. Peduto did just lose to a progressive candidate. I don't know that he's going to have the appetite for that fight again. Rich Fitzgerald has been the head of a county. He's sort of ruled supreme in Allegheny County. I don't know if he wants to be one of 435 people. Another couple of other names have been run around or being floated out there. I'm not sure I've heard one. Austin Davis, state representative from the district next door to Lee's. Talking about running for lieutenant governor. There are a couple other folks. I haven't heard somebody who's like, yeah, this is going to be the person. But there's a lot of room to run as a moderate Democrat in this race.
And 10 seconds. Any Republicans so far?
I haven't heard of any, but again, we're 24 hours into this thing. I'm sure something will happen.
Chris Potter is WESA's Government and Accountability Editor. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Kevin.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. There are more than 81,000 orphan wells across the country. That's according to a new analysis from the Environmental Defense Fund and McGill University. Pennsylvania has 8,840 of these orphan wells, which are oil and gas wells that were left unsealed or unplugged. Ted Bettner is a senior researcher at Ohio River Valley Institute, where he studies orphan wells. Ted, welcome to The Confluence.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate being here.
Ted, how are these wells created? Was it searching for oil and gas? Was it extracting it? What?
You know, if you go back to the history of the first oil boom in this country, it happened in Pennsylvania. So the Ohio River Basin, including Pennsylvania, West Virginia, Ohio, parts of Indiana, Kentucky, this was where the first oil boom happened. Then when all of that dried up, you know, the big oil companies, you know, moved outward, westward. In the wake of that, they left behind possibly hundreds of thousands of wells that were never properly plugged or reclaimed during that period. And we really don't have a good understanding of all of those wells, but state departments of environmental protection, mostly, or oil and gas divisions, have counted some of the wells that have been orphaned during that time, and also orphaned wells where the owner has abandoned that well and has become a ward of the state over the last 50 or 70 years. A lot of these wells come from that first oil boom that happened early on in this country in the late 1850s.
So the 81,000 figure nationwide may not be all of them, is what you're saying?
Oh, no, it's a drop in the bucket. There could be up to a million of them, I'd say at least. I mean, we don't have an exact measure of how many orphan wells existed. There are plugging records. You know, when you go back into the 1800s and early 1900s, you can find out how many wells were plugged. But we have to realize, too, this all happened before there were modern regulations. There were some regulations on their book, but there was no standard practice to plug wells basically until the 1950s.
Do we know who owns a lot of them, most of them, a few of them?
Well, if they're orphan wells, we don't know who owns them. Now, in some of the records you can actually find, some of them can be improperly marked as orphan, even though they have an owner. That can happen. But we know that some of the owners of these companies, you know, they either file bankruptcy, dissolve, go out of business, and then that well just sit there. So if you can picture, like, you know, back in the late 1800s, early 1900s in Pennsylvania, you know, a company owning some of these wells and then eventually going out of business and they just walked away. Mm-hmm. And this can happen if your state doesn't, if you don't have a big regulatory, if your state is not regulating those wells like they didn't. I mean, there are some regulations on the books. I mean, some of them had you like plugging wells with like tree stumps, you know, putting, shoving whatever you could down that well. By definition, if it's an orphan well, it doesn't have a proper owner that you can, you know, get to pay for that well to be plugged and restored.
Right. So abandoned wells are left there and we know the owners,
as opposed to orphan wells.
Abandoned is a much bigger term. Those are wells that can be inactive depending on their state's definition for a certain amount of years. Some of them could be, you know, re-drilled and be taken back to active status, but that's very, very few. So just to give you an idea, in Pennsylvania, you talked about those 8,000 orphan wells that have been located there. You know, there are an additional 57,000 wells in that state, in Pennsylvania, that are inactive or abandoned, and probably over at least another 13,000 wells that are just uneconomical. And all of these wells need to be plugged and reclaimed today. This is on top of the perhaps at least 200,000 or more additional legacy and orphan oil and gas wells that were drilled over 100 years ago.
Nearly 11% of the orphan wells are in Pennsylvania. What state has the most? Is there a state that has more?
I would say Pennsylvania has the largest legacy and orphan well problem in the entire country, because this was the epicenter of the oil boom. This is where it happened first, and this is where it happened in a period of very little regulation of those wells. So all of these things were left behind, and a lot of the the departments of environmental protection, like in Pennsylvania, don't have the resources to go out and send people to find wells. I mean, like, you would need a really good team of people, dozens of people, to go out, identify all of these wells. And the DEP has a small budget that they're dealing with, and they do a great job, I think, in Pennsylvania, of identifying the wells they can. But they need more resources if they're really going to go out and identify, especially these older legacy wells that we're talking about.
So how do they pose a threat?
Unplugged or improperly plugged orphan or abandoned gas wells, they can cause extensive environmental damage. They can also impose health and safety risks. That's because they're leaching pollutants into the air and water. And some of these wells are leaking large amounts of harmful methane into the atmosphere, which is a powerful greenhouse gas, as well as volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, that can damage local air quality, and both of which can, under circumstances, you know, pose serious public safety concerns. Just think of your drinking water getting contaminated from some of the things that are coming out of these wells that are leaking below the ground and above the ground. So, you know, for people out there, you know, this can undermine your drinking water. If you're a farmer, it can undermine your agriculture activity. And if you're a homeowner, you know, it means lower property values. Because if you find a well like this on your property, you know, there are sometimes there's money for this, sometimes there's not, but, you know, it can cost to $150,000 to plug in, reclaim that well. Sometimes it all just depends. If it's really close to your home, it costs even more.
That's one well, that figure you're talking about.
The average in Pennsylvania, according to the DEP, is around $33,000 per well.
By the definition, orphan wells, we don't know, we can't put the onus on a certain person or company to pay for this. So who foots the bill? Is it the taxpayers? And are the taxpayers paying for someone else's negligence?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, it's like negligence for a lot of times that happened 100 years ago. And that becomes an issue because, like, it's hard to go back and get that money from somebody that long ago. You know, and states do have sort of orphan well funds. You know, and some states dedicate more revenue to it than others. Like Ohio dedicates part of its severance tax to plug and abandon a lot of these orphan wells. The problem is, it's just completely, you know, inadequate. You talked about the 80,000 that have been identified right across the country. To put this in perspective, in 2018, so 3 years ago, you know, only about 2,372 orphan wells were plugged in the United States by these states. I mean, more were plugged maybe by companies, but this is how many were plugged by the states. So when we're talking about, you know, doing something to be able to pay for those, you know, it's hard to go back and find these previous owners. But I would argue too, but we look at the whole, all of these wells, hundreds of thousands, you know, altogether, there's more than 4 million wells that have been drilled in the United States. And I think the best thing to do is to create some type of program where you're, you know, putting a small tax on oil and gas production into a fund to take care of all of this.
You mentioned Ohio and a severance tax. Of course, Pennsylvania does not have a severance tax. It has impact fees. Ted, $33,000, about average, you said, to cap one of these wells. And it depends on the depth of the well. What goes into the process of capping one of these wells?
You know, there's all different types of techniques. States have different ways of plugging wells. Usually in their state code, they have different ways they go about it. Most of them use cement. You know, they use a drilling rig to go down into that well, and they use cement plugs, sometimes a gel plug. It all depends on what the state regulations are. And there really is, you know, to my understanding, not really a really best practice when it comes to plugging these wells, because every state does it a little differently.
Finally, do you think these orphan wells that have sat vacant for many years are seen as less important to take care of, to regulate, rather than an active plant or mill that might be spewing some emissions because the wells are out of sight compared to that mill, that plant?
I hope it's not an either or. I mean, I think there's things in the Regrow Act too to address brownfield and those types of things that we're talking about. But I do think this is a critical component. I mean, a lot of these wells are spewing methane that contributes to greenhouse gas emissions. It's an important part of that puzzle in dealing with climate change. But I would say the biggest reason to do this, too, is that we've seen a huge decline in oil and gas jobs in the region and in Pennsylvania over the last couple of years. And this is a way to increase the number of jobs in the industry as well.
Ted Bettner is a senior researcher at Ohio River Valley Institute. Ted, thanks for your time.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate being here.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh poet and educator Jan Beatty has a new memoir about her experience as an adoptive child. The book, American Bastard, explores the dark side of adoption. 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll began their conversation by asking Beatty about the myths surrounding adoption in America.
I think about them as the accepted cultural story of adoption, which is that it's so wonderful to be adopted, and, you know, the adoptees are the chosen ones, the chosen babies, and we're supposed to be grateful and so happy about it. In my book, you know, I'm talking from the adoptee's point of view and talking about the loss of medical history, the loss of our names, the broken bond with the birth mother, and how that is a primary lifelong loss that no one discusses. It's a business transaction. It's a sale of an infant, and no one really discusses it in the way it actually happens. I think that's really a problem, to pretend it's otherwise.
You were born in Pittsburgh in the early 50s. Talk about the circumstances of your birth and the circumstances under which you were given up for adoption.
Well, I was born in a place called Rosalia Asylum and Maternity Hospital in the Hill District of Pittsburgh. It was run by the Sisters of Charity. So back then, that was called a home for unwed mothers, which is a dated name, way to talk about it, but back then, you know, young women would come to these places, have their babies there, and then leave the babies there, and it would also function as an orphanage. So I was adopted from there, and I didn't learn my name, my real name, till I was 32 years old.
In the book, as in a lot of your poetry, there's a lot of blood imagery. The book really emphasizes the importance of that to you and to relationships that are based on blood rather than simply some kind of kinship. Can you talk about that, why that's important to you?
Well, yeah. I mean, that's everything. The body and the blood is everything to an adopted child. And I think to everyone, I mean, they may not think about it as much because it's part of their natural existence. But if you don't have that connection, if you don't have that link to your blood, it becomes really important. When I was growing up, I was an athlete, and I was, you know, on the softball team, the volleyball team, the racquetball team, the tennis team, and I was hitting things all the time. I was smashing softballs against the house and breaking windows, and my adoptive parents were saying, What's wrong with you? What are you doing? I said, I don't know, but I was very intensely competitive, and I started out in college as a phys ed major, and it wasn't until later when I found out my birth father was a professional hockey player for the Toronto Maple Leafs and the Pittsburgh Hornets, the Boston Bruins, the New York Rangers, but he won 3 Stanley Cups and had a reputation for cross-checking and fighting. I'm like, oh, so that's the blood. That's not some behavior. That's blood. So that's genetics. So how can blood not be important?
You've written about some of these encounters in your poetry before. You've written about being adopted and so forth. Why write a memoir at this point?
Well, I've been trying to write this book like my whole life, it feels, and I never thought I'd be able to write it. I feel like I needed to do more work in therapy to get to these places, and also I needed to grow as a writer to learn how I could possibly write this book. And I needed to write this big book because, as I said before, I couldn't find it anywhere. I couldn't find anyone saying anything like this because they were all making it nice, and that was driving me insane. And I wanted it written down that, hey, look, this is how it was for me, and this is how it is, I know, for a lot of other adoptees. The dedication to the book is, this is for the lost ones who never knew where they came from. This is against the ones who pretended the loss never happened. And I just wanted it written down.
That was 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll speaking with Jan Beatty about her new memoir, American Bastard. For today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Rebecca Reese, Laura Satsui, and Mary Lee Williams. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.